Ladies and gentlemen, we'll call this division meeting to order, and I'd like to welcome everyone here. And we are going to start out with three Representative Earhart bills. And the first one is 1502. Representative Earhart, would you like to move your bill for possible inclusion?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to move House File 1502 to be on the table and for possible inclusion at a later date in the omnibus property tax.
You know, and I'm sorry, we don't actually have a quorum quite yet, so when we do, we can renew that and bring those up if you're gone at that time. So,
Mr. Chairman, is that a division report?
It is a division report.
Okay.
So, go ahead and please proceed. And yeah, say if we can have quiet here, please. It's a small room and voices travel far. So
very comfortable in here.
Yeah.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in the huge and landmark property restructuring of 2001, one of the things that got done was that seasonal rec property, that's cabins, were taken off of the operation, the excess levy operations levies, and in return, they were added into the state general property tax. And it seems to me that was, I wasn't on the conference committee, but I was on the sideline screening, and I thought that was not the proper thing to do. There's no income coming in like the businesses have to help with property taxes, and we've got a lot of these folks who are trying to hang on to their cabins, and so I thought I'd at least bring it forth for talking points here. And with me is Jeff Forrester, and he's going to give a little first-hand testimony.
Mr. Forrester.
Chairman Mark Port, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forrester, and I'm the Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. And when this bill came in, we were told first that the money was going to be dedicated to a special educational reserve account, which was immediately made part of the general fund. I've never quite been able to figure out the policy purpose behind the bill. And from what I've heard, there was basically just a budget hole that they needed to backfill. And so they came up with this state general tax at the final hour and sort of plugged us in. I think it's unfair. It's about a $35 million a year burden. And I guess if there's any questions.
Thank you. First of all, and correct me if I'm wrong, staff, but on the state general tax, only the inflation every year or the increase after the first year base would go into education. There was an education reserve that basically equaled what it raised every year after the initial year, and that was about $15 million a year. And that only lasted for about a year or two, and then they took that. But the entire state general tax was not all to go to education, was just that little portion. And one reason that you had the state general tax is because if they had not done that, the reduction in 2001 in seasonal rec property would have been much greater than on residential homestead. Because when you took the education part off of the property tax, on the residential homestead, those owners were already getting about 83% of that as a credit. So they were only paying 17% the residential homestead, whereas seasonal rec was paying the complete 100%. So you take that off, it's a much greater decrease for seasonal rec. And then we compressed things and then actually took seasonal rec off of the operating referendum. So politically, if we hadn't, the state general tax was to make sure, one reason politically, that the cuts for seasonal rec were not greater than residential homestead, which would have been tough to explain. But so there was really, in 2001, a significant decrease for seasonal rec at that time.
Representative Marquardt and members of the committee, my memory, and I don't have the numbers in front of me, was that it was less than a percentage point decrease in 2001. Maybe House staff remembers, but I remember looking at the list, and there was one group that got less of a decrease than us, and that was rental housing. And then that decrease was wiped out the next year by escalating market values. So really, 2001 was a wash for seasonal owners.
Representative Winchester.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And Mr. Forster and Representative Earhart, maybe Ms. Baker can talk about this a little bit, or Mr. Hines, because we all have a different memory, obviously. And we did not have a deficit in 2001. We actually had a huge surplus, and so we were buying down the school levy. And then later, the deficit came. So at the time the shift was made, it was during the good years. And so we had a huge, huge deficit. People were calling it for loads of money at the time. And people were doing tax cuts and compression rates. And I think what might be getting confused here now is Mr. Forster is referencing the classification rate change. And I think Representative Marquardt is talking about the percent of relief relative to the property. And my recollection is similar to Representative Marquardt's. And I was a conferee. When the runs were done, due to all this moving around and buying out the education, kind of the big winners, way above and beyond anyone else, was cabins and commercial industrial. And as we looked at the runs, you know, we were going to see commercial industrial properties and cabins get such overwhelming tax breaks, I think to the tune of about 20% reductions, and homeowners getting 5, 6, 7. So there was an adjustment to kind of try to qualify or kind of make, you know, this politically saleable. Then in 2003, as the economy started tanking, then there were some other things going on. But I think for those who are not, they're neutral, I'm not, Representative Marquardt's not, you know, all of us legislators have a very difficult time being neutral and having good memories, and I think we rely on our nonpartisan staff to maybe sum up what they think happened, because I think it's important for people to know when they think about these cabin taxes.
If I can come back to staff real quick, Representative Earhart, Mr. Hines.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Winchesky, I think Representative Winchesky's portrayal is accurate. I think there was, and Representative Marquardt's characterization of the various trade-offs that were made in going to the 2001 system. I don't know if Representative Marquardt mentioned that seasonal rec property got a class rate reduction as well as a relief from the state general ed levy in the 2001 reform. But it was a complex trade-off with many pieces moving around. I think Representative Winchesky's memory is correct that we did runs initially, saw the gaps, played it by ear, and put some more in. And it was a juggling act all the way around.
Thank you very much. You're also very correct here. I've got the property simulations here from 01 to 02, and the seasonal rec, you said it went down 1%, 0.8 of 1%. So you were right on there. Mm-hmm. Residential homestead went down overall statewide 12%. But I remember, as Representative Winchesky and Mr. Hines just mentioned, the initial runs in looking at that, seasonal rec was much, it was like 20-some percent, and so was commercial industrial, and we looked at that and said, you know, we just can't make that happen. But, I mean, when all was said and done, there was not much of a decrease for seasonal rec, as you're saying there, which is correct, too. So fun with numbers and so forth. Representative Earhart.
Well, I just was going to say, Mr. Chairman, that I do remember my property taxes on my cabin were within $100 or what they were. A year before, there was a slight reduction, but you know, politically, you had to do what you had to do at that time. But it was not, you know, for years the cabin owners were getting beat up, so politically they weren't very happy about something. They thought they were going to get a reduction when they didn't. I mean, they always have complained about paying for taxes that they can't, taxation without representation, which is true and still remains true. Unfortunately, but I don't want to belabor this. We'd like to get rid of it, and that's why I brought it up.
You know, at this time, would you like to move? We do have a quorum, so okay. Would you like to move House File 1502?
Mr. Chairman, I'm going to move House File 1502 to be included in the, for possible inclusion in the division report, I guess is the correct.
Very good, thank you. Any other comments or questions for Representative Earhart and Mr. Forrester here? So anyone from the audience that would care to speak for or against House File 1502? If not, the chair will lay over 1502 for possible inclusion into the division report. Thank you much. Would you like to move House File 1902?
Mr. Chairman, I would like to move House File 1502.
Let's do 1902, this one next.
I wonder, I'm looking at the wrong one. Okay. 1902, for possible inclusion in the, for consideration and possible inclusion in the division report. This bill would put targeting for, put seasonal rec property on the same basis that we have targeting for homeowners, homesteads now. In other words, if your homestead property taxes on the gross basis, if I remember right, go up so much, you, after working the formula, can receive a refund, which is targeted for the specific increase in your property tax over the greater of 12% of the year, prior year's property tax payable are $100, and it's without regard to income. Excuse me. So it does the same thing for cabin owners as now done for homestead. Actually, I thought I was going to get a circuit breaker instead of a targeted for this, and we're still working on that one, but homeowners, as you know, get a circuit breaker, which is not the question at the moment. This is targeting for seasonal rec properties.
My name is Jeff Forrester, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, and we would support this bill. One of our main ideas has been the idea of a house is a house, and the closer I think we can get to that, the fairer the system will be.
If everybody understands this, Mr. Chairman, otherwise maybe Mr. Hines could do a better job of explaining how the targeting system works. We haven't had any bills on that.
Mr. Hines,
do
you
want to
go to review on property tax refund program, please?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Earhart, the proposal, as you've characterized it, would be do exactly the same program for seasonal rec property as is the case for homeowners, so that they would get a refund of if their property tax is increased by more than 12% and more than $100 would be the deductible over both of those two thresholds, and the refund would be 60% of that, capped at a maximum refund of $1,000 under this proposal.
Thank you very much. Any comments, questions for Representative Earhart or Mr. Forrester? If not, anyone from the audience care to speak for or against House File 1902? If not, the chair will lay over House File 1902.
Thank you.
House File 1816. Representative Earhart, move your bill, please.
This is a little different. You may come back and want this, but I don't think so. I'd like to move House File 1816 for consideration of possible inclusion in the division report. I've got a few handouts here. Do we have anybody that can help with those?
Yes, sir. Representative Earhart, I've been waiting for this bill and this presentation.
Well, this bill may be a little outlandish. And maybe the way I explain it will be a little outlandish, but nevertheless, it is something that should be considered. We've all been interested in reducing our property taxes, yet we have something that we're not doing that is causing our taxes, property taxes, to go up. Now, if I can find my handout here. That's one of them. I've been burning up the shoes.
Okay.
Yeah, right here. Macro. Do another one. You can, let's see, what else do we have? Might as well do them all at once.
All of these?
Yeah, do another one. Well, we can leave this one. Let's take that one off and move it back and get this one after that. Mr. Chairman, there is a handout there that describes, and I better wait till we get to this one. The one you got talks about the property taxes paid for too many roads. It was an editorial in the Minneapolis paper, February 21, 2007. And it was, came out of a study that I like, I asked the House Research to do. Here's my own. And they got the Royce Tournament of the Minneapolis paper happened to get wind of it, got a hold of Ms. Dalton and wrote the article. And that's what that was all about. It just says that, look, folks, we're paying for property tax, we pay for roads out of property taxes, and it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense. Because there are people not using the roads that pay property taxes, and especially those that are elderly that may not drive anymore, and they certainly like to keep their property taxes down. This is one way that we might be able to do it. The one I wanted is to, so you understand the money flow here, you all got this one that says short subjects? Yes. This is not quite as complicated as the educational formulas are for distribution of money, but it still has its own little quirk. And all I wanted to do was tell you that that highway user tax distribution fund gets money from gas tax, motor fuels, and the vehicle license tab. And then they divide it up. Well, forget about the 5% on the right for a minute, but 95% of it is divided, 62% to highway, trunk highway fund, 29% to the county state aid highway fund, and the municipal state street fund gets 9%. First of all, if you bond, none of this money flows this way. So anybody that's got a giant bonding scheme for a solution to our road dilemma is not looking at the way it's distributed. But beyond that, you will see that if monies go to, I think you probably got the handout that shows the distribution of these it would be entitled Research Department February 7th. And what it says is that the total property tax levy in 1988, the year that the gas tax was leveled out at 20 cents, the last time it was raised, was $3.7 billion. And the spending on roads by counties, cities, and towns was $510 million. As we roll through the years, and 2004 was the last year that we had figures for, the total property tax was up to $5.6 billion, and the spending by counties, cities, and towns was $1.420 billion, I guess would be the way to read that. And the percentage of total levy would have risen from 13% to 18.5%. Or if you knock off the, let me get this right, if you knock off the other levies, such as the school levies, you would find that the county plus city plus town levies for other than schools would be 3.2 billion, having risen from 1.6 billion, and we would now be at about 32% of the monies raised now going to paper roads, because that MSA formula and the county state aid highway fund have not been increased. So, and I'm going to show you, give you a little demonstration here.
Keith, this one is all right. I'm glad you have a blue mode tonight.
Yeah, Representative. Well, it was early in the morning when I left my house for that other demonstration. I didn't have anything else. In any event, what happens is when you squeeze the taxes or prevent them from flowing, what happens is they bulge out in another direction. So you know what has happened is the cities and the counties are not getting their flow from the normal sources you would expect for their roads. It's not there. So they've got to turn to somewhere, and they turn to property taxes. You got to keep the roads up. So when someone comes in and hollers at the mayor and the council, they say, we got to get these roads fixed. And they say, well, we're not getting any money from the state, the gas tax, and improvements. And so they say, well, then you guys are going to have to raise property taxes, which they don't want to do. And as a matter of fact, we have a wheels tax, which is in the metro area, which is $5 per vehicle residing, the cars that are residing in the county at the present time, but they have to offset the $5 wheels tax with an offset for the amount of money they raise from their property taxes. And rather than raise their property taxes more, there are three counties, Washington, Anoka, and Dakota, who have gone to the existing wheels tax. So we're kind of mixing up taxes here, but the point is they'd like to keep their property taxes down. We all would like to keep the property taxes down by attributing the needs to their, proper source, which is the user of the gas, which then would flow naturally through the system to help out the cities and the counties on their streets. Any questions?
Members, any questions for Representative Earhart? Representative Winchesky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Earhart, I'm a little confused by what you're doing here. I got the balloon part. And I think Representative Earhart, we all know bipartisanly that you have been key in getting Minnesota, all of Minnesota, understand this great transportation need. And I keep saying locally, and I talk to my Bloomington mayor and council, you know, when you come in and you use the local property tax levy to solve what the state is not doing, you take the pressure off the Minnesota legislature to vote for the funding. So I'm always trying to discourage that, quite frankly, Representative Earhart, you and I have communities that our net tax capacity is very high. We are relatively wealthy, affluent property tax basis. So if we just allowed people to go forward and levy for stuff, communities like ours would have everything and others wouldn't. And so are you trying to say in your bill, we're going to sort of cap how much we're going to let local units of government sort of bail out the state and keep the pressure back on the legislature to meet their responsibilities? Or how did the levy work here and the levy limit?
Representative Earhart.
Actually, Mr. Chairman and Representative Chester, this is for illustrative purposes. I don't believe, I wanted to make the point about the interrelationship between property taxes and gas tax. And I don't think that any of the municipalities would be very happy with a levy on their property taxes cutting off another source of money. Do we have this one other piece with the green lines on it?
I didn't see that one represented there.
That illustrates four actual cities. I don't know why we don't have that. Oh, here it is. I'm sorry. This actually illustrates Lakeville, Minnetonka, Burnsville, Woodbury as four metropolitan cities I could get my hands on in the short notice.
Just hold up just a second so we get that, and then we can follow you, Representative.
Okay.
Just hold on a second.
They all sent me graph forms, but I'm not going to cross those out. We'll just look at the figures.
Okay, yeah. Go ahead. Now I think we have them all in hand. We can follow you, so.
Okay. What it says is in 1994, and just selected years here, Lakeville was spending on its roads, I guess would be the right way to say it, $850,000, and from the property tax for roads, $393,000. By 2006, the gas tax was giving them $1.8 million, but their property taxes were now raised to $2.7 million. The national increase in gas taxes is from there are more people driving, more gas being bought, but the dollar amount, buying power of the dollar still remains the same, so they're not getting that much more. In the Minnetonka situation, it was, the city manager of Minnetonka testified at where I got this idea at one of the town meetings we had, probably out in Minnetonka. The gas tax that they were getting for the MSA, Municipal State Aid, we're calling it the gas tax money, $1.3 million in 94. The property taxes for roads were $1.4 million. By the time we got to 2006, gas tax that it was at $1.5 million, and the property taxes at $4 million for roads, and so on across the illustration.
So, Representative Earhart, you're saying in the example of Minnetonka, the difference between gas tax and property tax was $100,000 in 94, but in 06 it's $2.5 million.
Right.
That's being spent on roads, what they're receiving versus what they're having to levy for taxes.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. You know, those guys out there are going to get that money. It's going to bulge out there for them to fix that road no matter what.
Any other questions? Representative Earhart, do want to sincerely thank you because you really have championed this issue of the gas tax versus property taxes, and it's you put it into the debate, as Representative Winchesky said, around the state, and I applaud you for that. So
there may be somebody who wants to testify.
Is there anyone who would care to testify for or against this bill with no props, please?
Please proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Rob Benasek here on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships this evening. And we want to thank Representative Earhart for kind of illustrating, as Chair Lincheski said, the problems out there with the lack of state's involvement in investment in our state road infrastructure. And just want to make the points to take the opportunity to remind committee members that townships are responsible for 43% of the road miles in the system in the state of Minnesota. We spend over 50% of our expenditures on maintenance construction of roads. There's Representative Earhart has passed around some charts. The Transportation Alliance is shown how the local property tax based funding for Minnesota local roads and bridges on property taxes has increased from 92 to 2004. The League of Minnesota Cities has a chart that shows cities, counties, towns' own source spending on roads from 1988 to 2004, doubling. House Research, Pat Dalton, put together a memo for Chair Leader and understated the amount of money in our methodology of own source spending by counties, cities, towns. And in that, we can see that towns have increased the amount of money they're spending and actually levying against their own property taxpayers by 21%, 24%, 26% year over year, the last several years in a row the data is available for. The article in today's paper, which the chair was quoted in, talked about how increases in property taxes were going up more in the outstates. Part of that is because townships, the amount of money we're levying against our property taxpayers from 2000 to 2004 has doubled. And that's because we have such needs in the area of road infrastructure. With that, Mr. Chair, I'll stand for questions.
Thank you very much, Mr. Banacek. So, anyone else? Yes.
Mr. Chairman, members, my name is Ann Finn, and I represent the League of Minnesota Cities, and I also want to thank Representative Earhart for bringing this bill forward, and that is because we really appreciate the point he's been making on property taxes and the connection with transportation. I want to just talk briefly about the city perspective on this issue. We are hearing more with more frequency from our cities over 5,000 population that they do not have enough money for the 20% of their streets that are classified as municipal state aid streets. Now, I make the point about cities over 5,000 because there are 136 of them out of our 854 cities. And they are in a unique position because while the number of cities over 5,000 has been growing as our population grows, municipal state aid really has not. So the pie stays the same, and it keeps getting divided up smaller. Now, I also wanted to mention that cities of all sizes have been telling us that they've been making significant investments as far as cost participation in county projects. And perhaps what's most frustrating to cities, again, of all sizes, is that they have seen increasing shifts in responsibility for funding components of trunk highway projects. They are putting significant property tax dollars into items like stormwater retention, interchanges, frontage roads, and very expensive components of MnDOT projects, where if the locals weren't contributing that, the project simply wouldn't happen. And what happens when cities make those investments is that they defer maintenance on their own systems. So where they're the road authority for their local streets, in large part their residential streets, they're having to find other ways to fund those, largely with special assessments and, again, with property tax dollars. Exacerbating the problem is the fact that, especially in the metropolitan area, congestion on trunk highways is causing traffic to divert onto local streets, and that results in more wear and tear on local systems and shortens the lifespans of those residential and arterial streets. So with that, I'll wrap up my testimony. In short, the League is not advocating for this legislation, and my boss, Gary Carlson, who appears with some frequency before this, would probably make sure you never saw me again if I did. But I do want to, again, thank Representative Earhart for his efforts to make this point very clear to you.
Thank you, Ms. Finn. Thank you. Anyone else care to testify for or against?
Mr. Chairman, members, I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association. On behalf of our counties, I also want to thank Representative Earhart for bringing forward this bill to identify the problems with the inadequacy of state funding in driving our property tax levies and the inadequacy of maintenance and construction of our roads. The county system out there currently is larger than the state's trunk highway system. As I think all the members know, those portions of our system that qualify for state aid are guaranteed under the state's constitution 29% of the state's fuel tax revenues and motor vehicle registration fees. And we haven't seen any increases in terms of rate increases. In fact, have seen reductions since 1988. The consequences have clearly been exactly as what Representative Earhart has shown with the committee that our effort at the local level in terms of property taxes that we request of our taxpayers are increasing. As he's also identified three counties, all of which are members of my organization, have gone to a local wheelage tax to supplement those property taxes. And I'm here to tell you that even that's not enough. Two of those counties in particular, Anoka and Dakota counties, even though they're among the fastest growing in the state, are not looking forward to any state highway projects occurring in their geography over the next 20 years. Quite frankly, as has already been identified by other of the testifiers, our roads are substituting for what should be state trunk highways. The major east-west corridor in Dakota County right now is County Road 42. By all reasonable expectations, that should be a state trunk highway. But the county is having to step up and take the place of what should be a state obligation. Ms. Finn already identified the fact that we're being asked for substantial expenditures in relation to state trunk highway improvements. But furthermore, in the counties that I represent, we're also literally lending money to DOT to get interchanges built that would not occur for several decades under their current plans to deal with the safety issues and the capacity issues that currently exist. Again, I thank Representative Earhart for bringing forward this bill to make the point of the impacts of the property tax due to the lack of any increase in state funding. Again, we do not support the literal provisions of the bill, but I appreciate the bringing visibility to this issue and be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you much. Thank you, Mr. Carlson. Any other testifiers? Any closing comments, Representative Earhart?
Well, we're gratified that, Mr. Chairman, that several people came forth to reinforce my points here, so is that enough?
Thank you.
I would move on that we consider the House File 1816 for possible inclusion in the division report.
And the chair will lay over House File 1816. Thank you much, Representative Earhart. And if others don't mind, Representative Atkins needs to go now. So if you could come forward, and would anyone care to move House File 1751? And then we'll get back on schedule. So Representative Wapler moves House File 1751 for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative Atkins, and please proceed.
Thank you, Chair Marquardt. Members, if you have an A1 amendment, I'd appreciate if that would be moved as well to shape the bill up into the form in which you'd like to proceed with it.
All right. Members, you should have the H-1751-A1 amendment. Do I hear a motion? Representative Wapler moves one amendment. Any discussion? Hearing none, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. Then it is adopted. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Well, it's aggregate's important. If you want to build stuff, you need it. If you build on top of it before you mine it, you can't get at it. That's the issue that's faced in primarily in the metro area where there's a lot of development pressures. In Dakota County, which is home to a considerable amount of aggregate, there's substantial economic pressures to develop your property. Part of that is based on the tax treatment for that property, which is if you don't develop it, you have to keep paying higher and higher and higher taxes. So you're actually motivated to develop it before it's been mined. What this would do, this bill, and there's another bill that I've got, I believe that may be heard on Friday this week, to get at the same sort of issue. And everybody agrees, by the way, aggregate and getting at the aggregate is a critical issue. In order to keep construction costs down, we just talked about building roads and building the doing important things and so forth. If we're going to do stuff, folks, we've got to be able to get at the aggregate. The tax treatment of certain properties is such that you're encouraged to build on it before you mine it. What this would do is essentially apply green acres, which I know this group is all familiar with, to this sort of property. It would preserve the property at egg rates until it's mined, at which time it would become a commercial rate. And if you used it for anything other than that, you'd go back and you'd be having to pay back the taxes that you'd otherwise have to pay. The goal is to keep aggregate available at a reasonable price so that we can build stuff and move Minnesota's economy forward with it. I appreciate your deference in hearing this bill next. I do have actually some opposition testimony, although I don't think it's going to be the strongest opposition as much as it's going to be, folks, we need to get it aggregate, we need to deal with the issue. This may not be exactly the way that they want to approach it, but I certainly wanted to have folks here that wanted to testify with a different approach available, and I appreciate, Mr. Chair, your willingness to hear us. With that, I've got some testimony that will help elucidate the and explain the issue a little bit further.
Thank you very much. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Jonathan Wilmshurst from Rosemount. I've been in the industry 25 years. I've been involved in this issue in Minnesota for 15 years. This is all about saving the resources for the future generations. I live in Rosemount on the largest sand and gravel deposit in the state, and Dakota County has a huge responsibility to yield that resource for future generations, but it also has huge housing pressure, and this is all about trying to preserve the resource for the future. We've worked with the county extensively, the industry has, for a number of years to come up with a formula here that might work. It's ultimately the responsibility of the industry to protect these resources. They have a lot of money tied up in the deposits. In places like Maple Grove, where you have arbor lakes being developed right alongside a gravel pit that's been held for 30 or 40 years in some cases, those gravel producers have been put under pressure to pay the same aggregate property, same property tax rates as a huge development next door. And so this is about making it affordable for the industry to hold. In many cases, it's called a rule of thumb in the industry. You want to have a 20-year reserve ahead of you, and that is a huge investment to make for a very long period of time. So we think we've come up with a pretty good solution here. Just many of you are new on board since the legislature appointed the aggregate task force in 2000, made 14 recommendations. The only representative left on that committee now is Representative Rukavina. I would hate for something to happen to him before we pass at least one of these recommendations. Nothing has been done as yet, so this is one of the 14. Another one of the 14 is moving forward in a separate bill having to do with the aggregate tax or host community fees, depending on what you want to call it. So I wouldn't want to confuse you with a separate issue. So I'm here to answer any questions you may have, offering clarification.
Any questions for Mr. Melsness? If not, thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have any other testifiers on your behalf, Representative Atkins? Is there anyone who would care to testify for or against House File 1751?
Mr. Chair, members of the board, I'm Joe Harris, Dakota County Commissioner, and I'll just be brief. We're in support of the proposed piece of legislation that has been brought forward by Representative Atkins and the amendment that has been added tonight to the bill. So,
and you know, thank you, Mr. Harris. We didn't really. What does that amendment do, Representative Atkins? That we were supposed to put that in. I forgot to ask that.
Well, we didn't want to tell you. No, essentially what it does is it puts the control in the hands of the county. It's an opt-out provision for the counties. It was worked on with the Dakota County folks so that if it makes sense for a county to be part of this program, they could. If not, and I know you and I are big fans of local control, having been former mayors, and this is local control.
So that adds an opt-out.
Mr. Chair, you've got a two-year window in which to determine whether to opt out. There's an enormous requirement that you have to go through. And later on, if you want to get back to the program, frankly, you can. So there's an opportunity to go through it and become part of it again. I have great regard for our county board members, and I know that Commissioner Harris was critical in working on the language along with Mr. Tilley. That developed the A1 amendment, and we've accepted it and look forward to moving ahead with it.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Thank you. Representative Wofler.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Atkins, you're two witnesses. I understand the need for it, and I understand how we have to preserve aggregate because it really will impact our future. But I didn't see, and maybe I've missed it, in this where they have to establish that there actually is gravel there. I mean, I don't think your intent is that anyone could say there's gravel under my property and now I want to hang out. I want low property taxes, and then when I've got the development plan already, I'll pay the back taxes. I mean, I don't think that's your intent at all. And so I just thought we might want to, as we move ahead, look at a way to establish that this is a legitimate, potentially mineable chunk of property.
Representative Atkins?
Representative Lafferty, you caught me. I was trying to have this apply to my house. And I believe it's been pointed out, I think, by Ms. Baker, Ms. Chair, you have the... I've got the summary. I don't have the bill.
I mean, Ms. Baker did find that, of course, quickly, and it was page 7, lines 20 to 23. Says disclosure must include a statement from a registered professional geologist, engineer, or soil scientist, basically stating that
right.
Would be the case.
I was looking at the application part at the beginning.
Yeah, thank you.
I just know that Representative Atkins
is the anyone, thank you very much. If there's no other questions, anyone else care to testify on this bill? If not, Representative Atkins, any last comments?
Nope.
Then the chair will lay over House File 1751. Thank you much.
Mr. Chair and members.
Representative Hamilton, House File 1668, we're going to learn. I've had members ask me, and staff, what is a monosloped roof?
Just work for Representative.
And do we have someone that would care to move, Representative Luncescu moves House File 1668 for possible inclusion. Representative Hamilton, welcome.
All right, thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. What is a monosloped roof? Basically, it's a single pitch roof that what we're talking about is a roof that is put over a feedlot. I've had two beef producers in my neck of the woods that called and talked to me about this. We have language today that will exempt manure pits and other mitigation efforts to control runoff. And this is just one more form to do that. But basically, it's for beef producers, if you will. So, again, it exempts monoslope roofs installed over feedlots and manure storage areas from property taxation. And pretty simple and straightforward, I believe. I do have a testifier here, Mr. Bruce Clevin, if I could, Mr. Chair.
Very good. Mr. Clevin, is this the first time before this committee this year? I know you were around earlier this year, but I don't know if you testified.
Mr. Chairman, it is. It's in such good hands, we haven't had to work it yet. So I appreciate that. Mr. Chairman, Bruce Clevin, I work for the Minnesota State Cattlemen's Association. It's the beef industry. One of our members called Representative Hamilton, one called me, and so we know there are two of these out there. I think the section that this works on is 272.02 is the exempt property area with cemeteries, and I think there's 85 things. I think that Subdivision 15 allows real and personal property use for pollution control items to be exempt. Pollution control in our context on the farm has been things like things that will contain or collect runoff. So lagoons and dikes, lattice floors, and manure storage pits, earthen bays, and things like that to collect the runoff are currently exempt. The bill before you would add monoslope roofs to that. It's different in that it prevents the runoff in the first place. It's not a collection point. As Representative Hamilton described, it's a single pitch roof. The high side is probably, 30 feet maybe? The low side's 20 probably. On the high side, you got maybe some feed bunks. And that is put over an area where the grazing animals will gather to feed. And this structure then prevents the runoff in the first place by diverting it where it could be commingled, and then we don't have to have a containment device. We stop it up front. And so that's really the bill before you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you much. Any questions? Representative Hamilton, Mr. Clevenogo, I mean, how many would this apply to potentially? I mean, do you have a number on that?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, we were guessing. In fact, I saw Mr. Manson in the hallway earlier. We had a minute to visit about this. We didn't really know if it was more than a handful or not. Neither of us could come up with that. And like I said, we know of two. He got a call and I got a call. So how many, we don't have an estimate for, and we don't have a fiscal.
Representative Hamilton.
And I did receive a letter here from Minnesota Department of Revenue, and they just said a few properties could be affected. So that was their number, a few.
And you know, I just don't know what type of a cost would it be to build a on a slope roof.
Chairman, I think that's going to vary, of course, on size and pitch. Yeah. The smaller it is, the less pitch you need to have. The larger it is, the more to get the snow off, for example. I do know they're typically steel framed, and it's got a metal roof in most cases. They're not really wooden.
Oh, okay.
So certainly it's going to be more than wood. It's not a pole barn type deal with the V roof. It's going to be typical metal. And then an open floor. When you build a shed, probably the biggest cost is the concrete on the floor. And these are just open protection from the weather for the feeding area, typically.
Any other questions? If not, is there anyone else who would care to testify on House File 1668? If not, thank you so much. And the chair will lay over House File 1668. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Otremba, House File 1012, and while Representative O'Connor makes her way forward, we have a couple of sets of meetings to approve. If I could have a motion on the March 9th, 2007 minutes. Representative Anderson moves approval of the March 9th, 2007 minutes. Any discussion? If not, I will call for the vote on the March 9th, 2007 minutes. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Also, Representative Anderson moves the March 13th, 2007 minutes. Hearing no discussion, I'll call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion does prevail. Minutes are approved there. Okay. The bill summary is being passed out on this one as we speak here, and we need someone to move House File 1012. Representative Lanning, thank you, moves House File 1012 for possible inclusion in the division report. Representative Tremble, welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, committee, for allowing us to testify. House File 1012 establishes a program similar to Green Acres. Any parcel located in a township classified as agricultural or timber that abuts public waters must be valued by the assessor on the same basis as real land of the same quality that does not abut public waters. This is becoming a major issue in our rural areas where there are many farms and lakes. So I have several testifiers, if that's okay.
It's fine. Thank you. So just state your name and for the record, and then proceed.
Mr. Chairman and committee, my name is Roger Jazorski. I do farm. I live in Todd County. The reason behind this bill is a year ago, our county assessor decided to tax undeveloped lakeshore by the foot. And I feel that it's going to put an undue tax burden on some people that will force them to develop or sell their land unwillingly. I know the Clean Water Act has been a huge concern. If you don't mind, I'll read so I don't miss something. And lakeshore development is one of the causes of pollution. I believe it is easier and cheaper to prevent pollution than it is to clean it up. There is already severe pressure on our public waters, and taxing in this way will make it worse, and the end result will be no more natural, undeveloped shoreline left. This would be especially sad for all the undeveloped lakes that are classified natural environment. You might say this will lower the tax revenue, but if you consider the high cost of cleaning up the added pollution caused by more development, it evens out. Currently, there is no language in the state statutes that say an assessor should tax this way, and there is no language saying that he can't. In a phone conversation late last year with Mr. John Hagan of the tax department down here, he agreed that this issue needs to be addressed. Some suggest that a landowner can place his land in a conservation easement, which I know that is right. But when this is done, it basically places a deed restriction on his land. Also, money paid to the landowner for the easement can be substantial. Plus, the law states that an assessor must reduce the valuation of the land according to the value of the conservation easement, resulting in a substantially less taxes being paid on this land for the length of the conservation easement. This bill does not prevent the development of Lakeshore, but is meant to tax land bordering water equally with the same kind of land that does not border water, and to protect the land and the owner from being unwillingly forced to sell and develop. I believe there is already enough development pressure, especially on the small natural environment lakes, without forcing more through high taxation. I'm a supervisor in the township where I live, and I originally wrote a resolution pertaining to this, and it has passed all township and county channels, and currently this legislation is consistent with the objectives of the Minnesota Association of Townships. I thank you for this opportunity, and if there's any questions, hopefully I can answer them.
Thank you, Mr. Sazorski. Is there anyone else? Anyone have a question? If not, okay. I would like to call Mr. Hagan up from the Department of Revenue, because one of the questions has been, you know, why this might not qualify for Green Acres as it is potentially without even a change in law. So, appreciate Mr. Hagan coming forward. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Hagan. I'm Assistant Director with the Property Tax Division. And I don't dispute the testimony that there's a hardship on property tax in this gentleman. This bill appears to us from the Department of Revenue to be so similar to Green Acres that it really begs the question of if it's necessary. I believe in your situation you have timberlands that are not agricultural, so they don't apply for the Green Acres class. But I'm not disputing the fact there's a problem with taxes on certain properties that abut Lakeshore. Our concern is that it is so similar to Green Acres that we question the need for it, and how many properties it would apply to. There's a number of administrative issues that we're concerned with the bill. I don't know if you want me to touch on them or not.
Please do.
One provision of the bill provides that that if the property, they alert the assessor before it's planted or before a development permit is issued, and we're concerned that might be too limited, and there might be other potentials like meets and bounds description selling the entire property that should also trigger it if we were to proceed with it. We have a concern that the language in the bill provides for valuing the property once it is no longer qualifies as developed shoreline, which would be a significantly higher value than if it was just undeveloped shoreline. In the case of Green Acres, something like that. So a developed would be a significantly higher value, and it might greatly undo any benefits that might be accumulated. There's a real timing problem, we believe, and I think the author, Representative Trimble, is trying to be sensitive to not creating problems for the assessor, but I think it creates a problem administratively in as much as once the determination is made to develop the property, the next assessment year, the assessment would be modified to reflect that. Which would potentially you could develop or make a determination to develop a property in January, February, March, something like that. It wouldn't be subject to the new assessment until the following assessment, which would be January 2nd of the next year. Taxes would be levied and payable the following year. So you'd create a lot of problems in that area where it could be the individual might make a determination to develop it, and you'd have all sorts of problems with taxes, who pays what, and trying to split the tax. I think you'd create a lot of administrative issues. Another concern I have is the retroactive provision where the assessor values the property after the determination is made to sell a property. One would guess at that point in time the property owner is going to go forward and dispose of the property or sell a property. And that retroactive provision would preclude the property owner from any meaningful appeal opportunity. So if they didn't agree with the value, if the value is very excessive, as it would be if it was valued as a developed lakeshore, they'd have no opportunity to appeal the valuation. If they did, it would negate any potential for developing the property, which would be real problematic. We believe there'd be a lot of administrative nightmare involved with these administrative issues I pointed out. And as always, the department believes in not varying from the ad valorem concept of taxation according to value. We've spent a lot of work in the last year or so trying to get conformity and uniformity amongst assessors in the area of Green Acres and particularly Representative Trimble's area, making certain that Green Acres is implemented properly, and we're continuing to, and we're hopeful that our efforts will resolve a lot of the problems that exist out there.
Thank you for that, Mr. Hagan. If in fact, as you state, this looks so similar to Green Acres, why couldn't this apply to that? Is this a judgment call being made somewhere along the line, or, I mean, you know, we kind of get back to some of the issues we've talked about before, but...
Mr. Chairman, members, I believe if my memory serves me correctly, your land is timberland, so it does not qualify as agricultural.
It's agriculture. It's all classified agricultural. Some is timber, some is farm, but it's all classified agricultural.
Okay, Mr.
In my opinion, if it is agricultural, it meets if the farm and the open acreage meets the income requirements, it would seem to be a clear-cut case of poor Green Acres. I can't remember our colonization, so I don't remember the specifics. I do remember the colonization. I don't remember.
Mr. Sosorski, what?
Chairman, with Green Acres. In all reality, Green Acres also will place a deed restriction on your deed when you sign it up. And administration of any program like that is the cost of more tax dollars to administer it. This here just seems simple. You don't have to sign anything. You don't have to apply for anything. You don't have to do anything like that. Now, If you get people that do not want to see their land developed, if they're really determined to not develop that land or ever see it developed, there's other ways they'll do it. They'll sell that land. Not to pick on anyone, but let's say they'll sell to the DNR. Okay, the DNR in turn, the townships get PILT money payments, which is less than normal tax payments. So we lose tax base there. We, with our lakes and our DNR owned land, state owned land in our township, 23% of our township doesn't have a tax base already. Or we've also got the pressure from nonprofit groups. To name one, the Nature Conservancy. And when they buy a piece of land, there is no tax base. So the township loses taxes again.
Well, maybe I can call on... Thank you. I need to call on Ms. Baker. I thought this was similar to Green Acres, that you would have your property taxes kind of deferred until it was developed or sold. How does this work exactly?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the way I read Representative Otremba's bill, it is very similar to Green Acres in that it doesn't have a covenant or anything, nor does Green Acres have a covenant. We're kind of mixing up a little bit in that the Metro-Ag Preserve program, which is another program which is similar to these, does have a covenant. But neither Green Acres or this one does. In both cases, there is a three-year payback. This one's a little bit different on how it's computed, and I would argue that it's an easier computation, this one, than the Green Acres one, actually. But in the Green Acres one, it does restrict it to ag land, I think. I don't think timber can be in Green Acres. In Representative Otremba's land that is classified as timber, so that's one of the differences. As I recall in the work that I did with Representative Otremba in this past year or two on this kind of concept, one of the real big problems with this was that her county assessor didn't acknowledge that Green Acres was a program and said, we don't have Green Acres in our county. And that was not acceptable because Green Acres, you don't have a choice. If, in fact, you really do have land that has a highest and best use and another use, people can apply for it and they should be able to get it, and the assessor should place those two values. And so there was a lot of discussion on that. And as I recall, and John, maybe you can help me with this, but I think we had a provision that actually said that if, in fact, a taxpayer applied and was turned down, they had to send that application to the Commissioner of Revenue with a reason for why they were turned down, and that provision didn't make it, did it?
No.
No, that was thrown out in conference committee, and it seemed like a good provision in that it made kind of a check and balance as to whether or not, and it gave revenue an idea of what was going on. And, you know, I can't remember exactly why, if we didn't talk about it a lot, or, but anyway, that provision didn't go. Okay. But anyway, I think that's...
So, thank you, Ms. Baker. So I think there's maybe some adjustments we need to make that's probably something that's workable. Representative Latremba.
Thank you, Representative Markwart and Chair. We still are having those problems. And there still are a lot of ag land that are butting up to water. Some of them are wildlife, no public access, but we're being... taxed as if we were going to build million-dollar houses along those lakes. And so it's frustrating that we say that we can handle this in Green Acres, and then we still do not have an assessor who, I don't know if he doesn't believe in him or if he's the, if he's actually the county fundraiser.
Mr. Hagen, and Eddie Elbert and Zsa Zsa Gabor would not be happy without Green Acres either. Well, there's a young group in here. Well, it was really a bad joke. I apologize. This is a case where we have an assessor that simply is not recognizing something that's within law. How is that handled? I mean, how would that be handled? Can someone come in and say, you will enforce this law or recognize Green Acres?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, you're starting to hit on a problem we sometimes have with assessors, where we sort of have a loose regulatory authority over assessors, but we really don't have any real authority to modify behaviors that we don't agree with. We do have a state board of equalization where we can change values, but as far as implementing Green Acres on a case-by-case basis, I don't believe we have the authority, and if we do, we wouldn't have the administrative wherewithal to do it. I might add that I believe my understanding was, and I could certainly follow up on this, is that the assessor in question has made dramatic strides in placing properties on Green Acres, and properties, particularly on lake shores, on developable lake shores, my understanding was, it's simply an understanding, was that the assessor had placed these properties on Green Acres beginning, I believe, of the 2006 assessment.
Well, I think we get the gist. Mr. Zersky, you've got a comment. You got
thing. Every paper I pick up, my farm papers, the outdoor news, everything you read is the preservation of natural habitat and the dedicated funding to restore habitat. These lakes that I'm talking about, some of these lakes that he placed on this and taxing by the foot, are no different than some of the wildlife management area lakes in our township. And it just does not make sense. These lakes are not developed now. And if it's going to be taxed this way, there's only one way out for these people. It's going to get developed. And I'm sorry, it would be really sad to see this happen. I mean, I'm not talking about nice, big, beautiful lakes. I'm talking about cattail bog and stuff like that. These are not developable lakes. And there's no way they should be taxed by the foot and force people to do something like that.
Well, I appreciate bringing up this issue. We've talked about this too, Representative Latremba, and it looks like it is an area of concern we need to address, and appreciate you bringing this forward. Is there anyone in the audience who would care to, thank you, Mr. Hagen, who would care to testify for or against?
Mr. Chair, I'm Alan Parrish. I'm the chairman of our Todd Coney Association. This is a resolution that was brought to our association. I brought it forth to the state association through its LNR, and there was enough interest that it is part of our our booklet, you know, on the issues that we stand for. It is in the thing that the township folks passed around each when you first come down here a month ago. It's something that, and it's been touched on, the Green Acres don't apply to the timberland and the marshland. But if you're taxed by the foot, you're going to be forced to either sell it or develop it. And like Roger stated, that'll be wrong or bad for the numerous reasons. The other thing is Mr. Hagen testified to the point of the logistics of the paperwork. Well, there is no more paperwork. If it's being taxed the same 40 as it's been taxed for the last 100 and how many years, and if you're not changing the structure that it's going to be taxed, but it's going to be taxed the same as it has been, so what's the change? There's no additional paperwork, because in the past it's always been taxed as part of that 40 acres or 160 or whatever it amounted to. So there's no, it costs the assessor a lot less money to go out there and just do the 40 as it does by the foot. But somebody has to measure it.
Sure. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Tom Mann, the Hennepin County Assessor, and I represent the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers. I guess, first of all, I'd like to agree with what Mr. Hagen stated about the Green Acres. We certainly look at this bill, and there's a couple things that concern assessors. First is administration, adding another administrative program. And secondly, we get concerned when we vary from the concept of market value. Green Acres is already a program that's in place, and we would hope that assessors use that. I mean, I certainly do. We have another testifier who's an assessor in LeSueur County that can tell you that he has the same situations where he does use the Green Acres program and it works. I would like to clarify one thing. When we talk about timber, and if you look at 273.13 that it refers to in the bill, the timber classification requires exclusive use as timber. So to qualify here, you have to have a tract that's exclusively timber. And in that regard, we do have the sustainable forest program already in place for those type of tracts that pay them a credit by the acre. So there's a couple different programs here that already relate to some of these properties. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And we have another testifier. Mr. Chairman, committee members, Dave Armstrong, the Sewer County Assessor. And in our county, we've got probably 50 lakes, and we do have this problem that the gentleman is talking about. We've got a lot of farmland, abutting lakes, and we have implemented the Green Acres program. And basically, it was because of what Lakeshore property or what Lakeshore property is selling for. And it was having a big influence on the farmland around the lakes. So the program works. I mean, we've had farmers that are very happy with it. We explained it to them. We explained how it would benefit them, and they had no problem signing up for the program and going into the Green Acres program.
Do you want to come to my
home? Thank you much. Anyone else care to testify? Any comments from members here?
Mr. Chairman, can I say one more thing?
Go ahead. You bet.
The one problem I said with Green Acres is it's got a qualification. You have to sell X amount of dollars worth of goods from this property in a year in order to qualify. Okay, some lands will do that. You know, the farmer can qualify. But what about all the hundreds and thousands of acres of land that's the same identical land that there is no income off of and they don't qualify for Green Acres? I mean, what will protect that? Green Acres does not protect that. Like I said, with just a statute that says you just tax it the same as any other land of the same quality, there's no need for a program, a site to sign up and people to qualify for or anything like that. That's the way it's assessed. It's just the same whether it touches the water or whether it doesn't.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Trimble, any closing remarks?
Just again, thank you. And, you know, we talk about income, but when you look at the farm prices out there now, some of that might need to be looked at because that we have off-farm incomes because we can't make it with just farming. So I thought that maybe Green Acres should take a look at that, because they're farming, but they're just not making any money, and they're going to town to get health insurance, so they take up another job. So they're still farming, but they're being punished because they don't have the good market value.
Thank you. The chair will lay over House File 1012, if possible. Please. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
House File 1900, Representative Slocum. And would someone care to move House File? Representative Chesky moves House File 1900 for possible inclusion. And Representative Slocum, you do have an A1 amendment.
Yes, I do.
And Representative Roffler moves approval of the A1 amendment. Hearing any discussion, hearing none, I will call for a vote on the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye. Those opposed say nay. The amendment is adopted. Would you care to explain your amendment very quickly, what it does or incorporate as you talk about the bill, either which way?
It does a very small thing, actually. It just changes the continuous feet from 200 to 400. It puts it in line with the Senate version.
Very good.
That's adequate? Any questions about that?
Please explain your bill.
Okay. House File 1900 establishes a new property tax classification for unimproved lakeshore real estate. What's excluded is agricultural land. It's a really good bill, and my heart is in it, and at some point later, committee members, you may certainly talk to me about why my heart would be in this, but it's kind of a personal thing, very long term. It provides an incentive to lakeshore property owners who keep their land and shoreline undeveloped. Natural terrain, natural vegetation, no structures. The overdevelopment of our state's lakeshores has increased the people pressure and subsequently the pollution that we're seeing on our beautiful recreational lakes. And we are at a fairly critical point. We have talked water quality in a number of different committees here at the legislature. This bill provides a tax incentive for property owners to maintain a natural shoreline and habitat. And then I'm going to refer to my testifier to introduce himself to you and to tell you more about this bill.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jeff Forster, and I'm Executive Director of Minnesota Seasonal Recreational Property Owners Coalition. And I'd like to thank you for taking the time to hear this bill, and thank Representative Slocum for carrying it. But there's been a lot in the news lately about what's happening on our lakes and what's happening with the water quality. And this is a critical question. There's over 90,000 miles of shoreline in Minnesota, more than California, Florida, and highway combined. About one-third of our lake shore is in private ownership. And you can ask, what is the value of undeveloped shoreline? And there's been a number of studies that have looked at this. A 1996 study in Maine concluded that a 1 meter increase in lake water clarity resulted in increases in property prices ranging from $11 per front foot to $200 per front foot. A study in New York not long after had similar results. Three researchers from Wisconsin looked at land values from 1997 to 2001 and found that, and I quote, "Restrictions on a lake based on its level of development and sensitivity to environmental change increased market value of shoreline property. People are willing to pay more to live on a lake that's protected from degradation." In 2003, a Babinji State and Minnesota Pollution Control Agency report found that for each meter increase in water clarity, the value of a front foot of lakeshore rose by $423. A 1 meter decrease in water clarity cut values by 594 feet. The DNR tells us that one of the main causes of surface water pollution in the state is overdevelopment of lakeshore. And there's intense pressure on property, undeveloped lakeshore right now. I included some letters from our members and some property tax statements. And what's happening is people of more modest means are being forced to sell. The gentleman before me spoke about conservation easements, and right now I've heard from a number of owners that have put their land in conservation easements and have not gotten a property tax reduction. And in fact, there's language out now that would change the language in the statutes from real property which is subject to a conservation restriction or easement shall be entitled to a valuation, to reduce valuation, and there's language to change it to may. So even that language is becoming weaker. So what happens is you can put your land into a conservation easement and you can take a huge income tax break, but not necessarily a property tax break. So people that are retired and on fixed incomes can't afford to conserve the land. So right now our property tax code is driving development of undeveloped shoreline. We have been working as a state to try and get statewide shoreline regs adopted, and that's been spotty. Those counties that have adopted the new shoreline regs are granting variances up to 80% of the time. And this seems like a good solution because it's statewide and it would allow people to do the right thing. We did some research, and 86% of the seasonal owners in the state do not want to sell their land. 6% of the seasonal owners in the state, about 12,000 families, are afraid they're going to have to sell in the next 3 years because they can't afford the taxes. So I suppose in the interest of brevity, I was going to also say that this bill has been around for many years, and the question can be, why hasn't it passed so far? And the devil has been in the details, and how many feet of shoreline to qualify, how to frustrate the attempts of speculators who would use this legislation to benefit themselves, how to keep its implementation simple enough so as not to overburden already busy assessors, and the Department of Revenue. MSRPO has been working with assessors, the DNR, and the Department of Revenue to address any concerns they may have in these areas. Our intention is not to give property tax breaks to speculators, but to allow people to do the thing that they want to do anyways. I think, by and large, I guess I can cut it short.
Any questions? Mr. Forrester, or Representative Slocum, any magic to the class rate of 0.6% for the 2C property?
I don't know. It's what it's been. And it just kind of is one of those numbers that's sort of carried along as different people have looked at the bill, and that seems to be the one that doesn't bother people. I would think the lower it was, the better it would be. You know.
Sounds good. Anyone in the audience would care to testify for or against House File 1900? Mr. Vanacek is moving forward. Mr. Carlson's getting in place. Goodness gracious.
Or should I take my way?
Please proceed.
Good evening, members. My name is Rob Vanacek, representing the Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers this evening. And we'd like to point out that this bill has been around for a number of years. I should point out we have recently entered into discussions with the folks, and we'll be talking with them tomorrow afternoon to try and troubleshoot this bill. But I want to point out, this bill would create a new class. You could simply lower the tax rate on the existing class for folks. Cause a tax shift in the taxing jurisdiction. If it's in a township, the property owners in the rest of the township across the street from the lake, they'd be having to pay a little bit more, or if they're in town, if they live in the same county and so on. Minnesota Association of Assessing Officers believes that things such as limitations, deferments, or exemptions creates inequalities between taxpayers. And we support efforts to make the classification rates, classification system more simple, more understandable to the property owners out there, making it easier to understand, streamlined administration costs to counties, cities, local jurisdictions, the tiered classification system increases the complexity of the system, produces unexpected property tax consequences. A couple things, if we're concerned about, doing the maintaining the shoreline and improving the clarity of lakes, well, we could do that by doing a permanent easement on the portion of the parcel that you'd like to make it so it'd be unimproved in the future. The assessor would recognize that's perpetual covenants, and the property value would go down because you could not develop it. You would see your taxes go down on that portion. Also, just a couple things that need to be troubleshooted is, in the bill, what's the definition of unimproved? If you just stop mowing that portion, that 400 feet, what is the natural restoration to natural terrain? Assessors really don't have a way of, IDing that as well as one might hope. And who enforces and what are the penalties if they get out before the 8 years are up, 7 years are up, so on?
Thank you very much, Mr. Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'm Keith Carlson, Executive Director of the Minnesota Intercounty Association, whose members include several counties whose taxpayers who do not qualify for this legislation would be adversely affected by the bill. First off, I would urge the committee to not be naive and believe that this will result in the preservation of 1 foot of undeveloped lakeshore in the state. It's not the tax system that's driving the development of lakeshore. It's the demand for that property, particularly by my generation, the baby boom generation. That generation has shown that it has an insatiable appetite for this property, and by enacting this bill, all you will do is push the development down to an adjacent property that does not qualify or does not care to come under the provisions of this bill or to another lake. It's not going to preserve undeveloped lakeshore. It will shift and increase the taxes, including to some other owners of undeveloped lakeshore who may now hit a threshold due to the higher tax where they will decide they can no longer afford to keep that property and will choose to now sell the property and result in its development. Exactly the opposite of what the intent of this legislation is. I further urge you not to be misled and believe that because it's partially structured with the characteristics of the existing Ag Preserve Law and the Green Acres Law, that will somehow result in the preservation that the proponents suggest it will have. First, it doesn't have all the provisions of the Ag Preserve Law, including that the property be zoned exclusively for undeveloped, nor does it have the provision that says that public services cannot be extended to the qualifying property, such as sanitary sewer. But the real bottom line is that the Ag Preserve Law that has been in effect for a number of years in the Twin Cities metropolitan area simply has failed miserably to preserve farmland. Anybody who resides in this area or who is familiar with the area knows that the amount of ag land that exists in the Twin Cities metropolitan area has dropped markedly. The laws had no effect in preserving that property. What it has had the effect is giving a tax break to the owners of these properties. I will finally point out, despite the contentions to the contrary, that there is an option for individuals who are facing true development pressure and rising values in their property, and that is the conservation easement. If the property's value is being increased because adjacent properties or in the immediate area are being increased in value because development is beginning to occur in that area, the conservation easement does allow that property's value to be decreased. and we can provide you with any number of examples, including substantial properties up on the Whitefish chain, some of the highest priced property in the lakeshore property in the state of Minnesota. The only reason that I can conclude why people don't want to avail themselves of that provision and want this instead is because they don't want to make the long-term commitment to preserving that property. Instead, they want the option 9 or 10 years down the road to sell the property off and develop it once they have gotten the benefit of the tax break. Mr. Chairman, members, that concludes my comments. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Seeing none, thank you. Anyone else care to testify for against House File 1900? If not, you've had closing comments, Representative Slocum, absolutely.
If you look at the bill, in order to apply for this covenant to do this, you have to have owned the property for 7 years minimum, and it has to be in effect for approximately 8 years. It really, this bill minimizes any speculators, any quick and dirty schemes, and it's really intended for legacy property that's undeveloped that a family may own and has owned over a long period of time.
Thank you very much. Thanks for bringing this forward, Representative.
Anytime.
So the chair will lay over House File 1900 for possible inclusion.
Thank you.
There's members out and about in committees, but Representative Hackbarth. We will hear your bill next, 1731. If someone would care to move Representative Hackbarth's bill, Representative Winchesky moves House File 1731 for possible inclusion. Welcome, Representative, and please present your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members. I appreciate the hearing on the bill. Pretty straightforward. It's a property tax exemption on an electrical peaking plant that's going to be built in my district in the city of Elk River, Sherburne County. And with me today, it's going to be built by Great River Energy. And I have Mr. Lancaster here with me today from Great River Energy to give you further explanation of the bill.
Mr. Lancaster, please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good evening. And good evening, members of the committee. I do have a handout here if there's someone here who could...
Right, that we do.
Yeah, my name is Rick Lancaster. I'm Vice President of Generation at Great River Energy. We're a not-for-profit generation and transmission cooperative. Our headquarters is in Elk River. We provide wholesale electricity to 28 distribution co-ops in Minnesota. They serve 600,000 homes, businesses, and farms, and about 1.5 million people live in the homes that we serve. We have a need for approximately 150 megawatts of peaking capacity in 2009. We're a fast-growing utility. Our load grows about 3-4% a year. By load, I mean the need of our consumers for electricity. We will not have enough power to serve our members' needs by 2009. We need what's called a peaking plant to do that. It's a natural gas-fired power plant with fuel oil backup. Elk River is a good site for us. We already have a power plant there. There's natural gas lines in the vicinity. There's good transmission there. We also have the support of Sherburne County and City of Elk River for the personal property tax exemption that we're requesting. And in the handout, there's resolutions from the city and county, and also a letter from the Minneapolis Building and Construction Trades Council, who is supporting the project. The main benefit of this is it increases power reliability and our ability to provide electricity to our members. It also, because it's a peaking plant, peaking plants are combustion turbines. They start quickly, they ramp up and down quickly, and they allow us to back up wind power. And as we add more wind power to our system, the legislature passed a law earlier this session, which we supported, that would allow us to increase our renewables to 25% by 2025. We'll need to add more wind power, and we'll need to add more of these peaking plants so that we can follow our load up and down and follow wind up and down. There's also jobs. There's 80 to 100 skilled craft jobs for the year that'll take us to build the plant, and three operators. The plant will run primarily on very hot or very cold days when load is high, when the transmission system needs some support, about 10% of the time. It's not a plant that runs very much. It's fueled by natural gas, and because they don't run very much, very low air emissions from the plant. It's a very clean plant. We still need to get permits to build the plant from the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission, a certificate of need, a site permit. We also need an air permit from the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency. Schedule for the project is we start the permitting this summer. That takes about a year. Start the construction early next summer and have it online by May of 2009. For the personal property tax exemption that we're requesting, there have been over two dozen of these granted for electric generating facilities since 1994. Most have been for gas-fired peaking plants such as this one. It makes these types of facilities in Minnesota competitive with other states. Surrounding states do not have this type of taxation on power plants. We would still pay the real property, the tax on the land and the buildings. And this type of tax relief is very important to us in our decision on where to locate new facilities. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Lancaster. Any questions? If not, anyone from the audience that would care to testify for or against this bill? If not, Mr. Representative Lucheski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for Ms. Baker. Could you provide for the committee, before the division report was put together, there have been a bunch of these that this has been provided to. Can you just give us a comprehensive look? Have they all had this exemption? I'm trying to remember, because I think for decision making, it's good for us to know. You want to comment, Ms. Baker?
Ms. Baker.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lynn Chesky, this primer that Steve Hines and I did, and we just updated it now in October of 06, so it includes the 06 legislation. For the last 20 years, Minnesota, or the legislature, has exempted all of the attached machinery that's come before, and including expansions and peaking plants and some of which were never built, most of which were, but goes through a laundry list of all of those that have been exempted, and it's just for the attached machinery, so it's exact same language, and it's very site-specific, like this one is, that says it has to be located within, you know, certain kilovolts, and it has to primary fuel has to be, you know, gas or whatever. I mean, everything is very, very specific in it. And some of them request local approval or require local approval. Some don't. Some of it requires local in-lieu payments to be agreed upon. Some don't. So there's a little bit of variance there. But all of them have exemptions like this.
Thank you for that summary.
Thank you for asking for that. I know that. And it sounds like every one has been passed by Representative Winchester, so this would really make some headline news if an author actually brought one that did not pass. There would be quite a news story there. Representative Hackbarth, any closing comments on that? I think the track record looks pretty good.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and I would add that we are in the Energy Committee right now, and I have to get back to that, and we are hearing the global warming bill of Representative Ruth, and I understand that she is going to be offering an amendment to that bill that's going to exempt these kind of natural gas peaking plants from her bill. So that's all good stuff for us.
Very good. So, well, thank you so much. Good
thank
to
you.
Have you before the committee, and the chair will lay over House File 1731.
Thank you very much, Chair. Thank you, members.
I think the next one that we can see here is Representative Schumper. If you can come forward with your bill, House Bill 1959, and Representative Walker, would you care to move that? She moves that for possible inclusion into the committee report. And Representative Schumper, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I do have a handout here.
Yeah.
Okay.
Representative Sober, you're next. You're on deck. After we just called him, but you're beyond deck. So good timing.
Okay, Mr. Chairman, committee. This is my sole, or not my personal attempt at bringing about some property tax relief. Something that occurred to me and that I got a lot of feedback about during the campaign last fall. And essentially it has two goals. One is to provide some property tax relief for farmers because of the inflating land prices, and I'm sure you can all understand that. And secondly, is to create a friendlier climate for school bonding referendums. We're having a really difficult time passing school bond referendums in rural areas, and it's because the farmers just feel, even though they support public education, they just feel they can't pay for them with these high property taxes. So I thought a lot about that, and I had some excellent help from Mr. Hines, who's on your staff here, and we spent a lot of time looking and thinking and trying different approaches, and this bill is a result of that. The parameters I set up is that I wanted something that was simple and easy for the public to understand. I wanted something similar to the tax relief for school operating referendums, and I'm sure all of you know that the operating referendums apply only to 1 acre and a house. So I wanted something similar to that so the public can kind of compare the two. And third, the other parameter was I didn't want any shifts to occur. I didn't want property taxes reduced for one group of people and shifted to the others. And so if you look at, I think, probably either the green sheet or the first sheet, page one of the actual bill, this is for school bonding referendums. It's tax relief for ag and timberland, and I do have a fiscal note. I think it's a yellow sheet of paper there. It shows the amounts of money we're talking about. The house and 1 acre on any farm is not included in this tax relief. We accomplish this by using a 33% tax credit against the agricultural tax liability for agricultural land. And essentially, the state is simply going to reimburse each district for the amount of the credit that's given. There are no shifts in this. We're not shifting any of the tax burden to homes in the small towns, for example. And the handout that I had is a really good example because if you want to look on the page that's see if I kept a copy of it here. The Chatfield one, the Chatfield page. There's an example on each side, two different school districts in my legislative district. But if you look on the Chatfield side, District 227, Chatfield is a school district that has tried three school referendums, bonding referendums in a row, and had all three of them defeated, one on election day. And again, it's primarily because the farmers don't feel they can afford the property taxes. The numbers are fairly straightforward. And again, Mr. Hines helped me prepare this. And if you go about two-thirds of the way down the sheet and you see the current law and what the property taxes would be, comparing it to what would happen if you were to include 1959 in your omnibus tax bill, you can see the residential homestead values all stay the same no matter which law. And you can see the farmsteads change because of this law. And you can see the commercial and industrial properties stay the same also. So there's no shifting. And it comes to fairly significant property tax relief. I think most of you know I'm a farmer. And, you know, anytime you could save $500, which several of the examples show on your property taxes, well, you feel pretty good as a farmer. You know, that's a pretty good deal. So, ready to answer any questions, Mr. Chairman?
Anyone have any questions So in difference to the bills that we heard last night on levies, this actually has a tax-based replacement aid. So there's no shift at all. It, whatever was dropped on the ag land, much like what we did when we took ag off of operating referendums, we had, especially for those districts that had a large amount of ag land, but few students, and would have really pushed it on to the homes we put on replacement aid. So this does that, and it doesn't go all of the way. It's 33%.
33%, so, right. And it, as you can see from the fiscal note, for fiscal year 09, it's about $14.4 million, $16 million in 2010 and $16 million in 2011. So, and if I can, Mr. Chairman, just if you flip the example over, you look at Caledonia, which is also in my school district. Caledonia currently has a bonding that they're paying off, and again, you can see. So it will be retroactive also, I guess is the point I was making. So, and I think, Mr. Hines, you can confirm this. It applies to all the ag land in the state, correct?
Mr. Hines?
Yes, that's correct.
So for $14 million, you can buy a lot of happiness among farmers.
Representative Winchesky, you heard about happiness tonight. What's your comment?
$13 million for happiness?
Yes.
Wow. Representative Shumpert, you weren't at the hearing last night, but no. There were lots of bills similar that Representative Marker has pointed out that you're actually paying for yours, and we spent a lot of time talking about finding the money to solve this problem, and I think we all know it's a very serious problem, and these school districts are in really tough shape. And now I heard you say the retroactive piece, and I'm going to ask Mr. Hines, do you know the price tag on Representative Schumper's bill, how much of that is retro and how much of it's not?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Lanchesky, I don't. I would imagine that it would be almost all retro. And it would really hinge on how much the Department of Revenue would have built into their assumptions about how much new bonding there would be, and I don't really know what that is and how accurate it would be anyway. But by and large, this is mostly covering existing.
Thank you,
that's right. Yeah, I can see your point. Yeah.
Well, in rough sense, so I just raised it because really, you're not shifting it on someone else. Which is good.
Right.
The one of the things that I think members, no one said this, but I just think some of the members who were thinking about this last night were thinking new levies. Now that won't solve Caledonia's problem or Chatfield's. I guess it would solve Chatfield's, wouldn't it?
Yes.
So, you know, we might have to pick one side of the sheet. I mean, that's the problem in the tax committee. But
I
think that's
that.
One of the things that people are struggling with. What would you do going forward? Versus trying to go back in time, and that's, you know.
I understand that. And, you know, if you think about, you know, some of the school districts may have passed bonding referendums 15 years ago, and they're still paying for them, and some of them may have passed some last year, and they're still paying for them, and so how far back, or do you exclude everybody who's already done it, and so on and so forth. So, you know, it's a tough call, and it, you know, I guess it just mostly depends on the numbers on the yellow sheet here and how much you can afford to put into this. I understand that, but I thought it was a pretty interesting approach in that it's really simple, you know, because we experimented with a lot of other things, like equalizing things to get rid of the shift effect, and that was way beyond my comprehension, and beyond, you know, I'm always concerned the more I spend time here is just the ability of the public to comprehend how we tinker with everything, and this would be pretty straightforward to explain to a group of farmers at a town meeting. So,
well, Representative Shumpert, before you go here, is there anyone who would care to speak for or against this House file? And as Representative Winchesky stated, we had many bills last night, and many of them dealing with ag land, of course, specifically. So we know the needs out there, and appreciate you bringing this forward. The chair will lay over House File 1959 for possible inclusion. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
so we have either Representative Soberg or Representative Mulry right here is chairing. Okay, is Representative Soberg coming through the door for the main event? And let's hear from does he have his entourage? Here he is, there, Representative Silver makes his way to the arena.
Well, thanks a lot.
Is that
Mr. Chair? You know, Marquardt is, you know, he has this obsession with wrestling and we couldn't find him in the Capitol during the state wrestling tournament, CXL. But, so he, you know, he's always in that arena. But Representative, or Mr. Chair, members, I think Representative Solberg has some big news to tell us.
Oh, Representative Solberg.
Actually, I was celebrating a little bit with my wife and family this evening. That's why I was a little bit late. I am the new proud grandfather of a 5-pound, 14-ounce baby boy.
Right.
Take some time to smell the roses.
Exactly.
So, Mr. Chairman,
go ahead.
Well, thank you.
We'll move that first, and I see you have an amendment, but we'll have Representative Winchesky moves House File 1531 for possible inclusion, and Representative Winchesky will move the A1 amendment, and to get this into the form that the author would like, so hearing debate on the A1 amendment, hearing none, I will call for the vote. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. The A1 amendment is adopted. And Representative Solberg, did you want to talk to the amendment, or just as you talked about the
amendment? Mr. Chair, a couple of things. We've adopted the amendment, and we are talking with Karen Baker about possibly some other additional words that need to be added to that. So I want to inform the committee that there may be an additional clarification or narrowing down of this amendment as it goes forward to the next facility, next committee, because we want to make sure that it's narrow as to make sure it solves the problem that is perceived to be out there. And Mr. Chair and members, I have with me Mr. Bill Straczynski, who can explain the bill as it relates to some apprenticeship programs that are offered by unions and others who have specific apprenticeship facilities, and there's been kind of a different interpretation of the law, but all of a sudden they're non-profit, but they're being at first case of property tax. So if I can introduce Mr. Straczynski to introduce other people as well.
Thank you very much and welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. You know what I've just been doing? I'm Bill Straczynski, and I'm representing the interest of the Sheet Metal and Air Conditioning and Roofing Contractors Association, SMARCA. And I have with me tonight Mr. John Kornstrom, who's intimately involved in this particular initiative and effort. And I just turn the mic over to Mr. Kornstrom. It's okay, Mr. Chairman?
Yes, it's fine. State your name and please proceed.
My name is John Kornstrom, and I am the Director of Labor Relations and General Counsel for SMARCA, which is a Sheet Metal Air Conditioning and Roofing Contractors Association. We are a trade association, represent about 350 contractors across the state, and our contractors employ approximately 3,500 construction workers. So in that capacity, I am personally involved with a number of different apprenticeship programs, and the largest of which is our Metro Area Sheet Metal Program. That program owns its own school. It's up in White Bear Lake. It's actually an old school building that was purchased from White Bear Lake School District. And for the that was purchased in 98. For the first 7 years or so, it was characterized as a school by the Ramsey County Tax Assessor, therefore exempt from property taxes. It's my understanding the old assessor retired or was replaced in some fashion, and a new assessor came in and said, I don't agree with that definition of a school, and therefore levied property taxes. As we looked into this issue and decided how to proceed, we checked on some of the other programs that own their own school building. And we found that this really varies from county to county across the state. Some counties recognize apprenticeship schools as schools, others do not. And so it is for that reason that we support this bill and encourage you to adopt it. We believe that apprenticeship programs are very beneficial to the state of Minnesota. in that setting the property tax issue aside, really the only support for apprenticeship programs that's provided by the state is the supervision through the Department of Labor and Industry. That works out, my understanding, to approximately $30 per apprentice. But our apprentices, you know, they go full-time, or, well, it's about 200 hours of instruction per year. If they've gone through tech school, they do an additional 3 years. If they have not gone through tech school, they come in and do 5 years. They earn very competitive wages. The entry-level apprentice in our program has a total wage package of $29.31 per hour with a taxable base of $1,803. Assuming they go through, they go to school, they do everything they're supposed to, they advance on to become journeymen. The journeyman in the metro area has a wage package of $50.13 an hour with just shy of $35 an hour as a taxable base. So we are turning out people that are very productive citizens. They earn good wages, they have solid pensions, they have health care, good family health care. We believe this is an investment for the state of Minnesota that's really beneficial. It turns out productive citizens. You compare the amount of money that goes along with supporting the state college system, and our graduates compared to the state college system graduates often will earn very comparable wages. We believe that in the interest of fairness, public policy, and return on the dollar that this bill should go forward and be adopted. On behalf of our contractors and the apprentices that we employ, we encourage you to adopt this bill.
Thank you. I know Representative Lincheski has a question.
I have a question for staff. Okay. I had to get the Constitution.
Good grief.
Article 10 of the Constitution, Minnesota Constitution, Representative Marquardt and I know is the taxation.
You're never supposed to read it.
But for staff, you know, maybe the debate here is on the exclusively for public purpose, because in Article 10, we're prohibited from taxing public entities. Right here, it says taxes shall be uniform upon the same class of subjects and shall be levied and collected for public purpose, but public burying grounds, public schoolhouses, public hospitals, academies, colleges, universities, all seminaries, and goes on and on. With all the properties, we can't put the tax on. So I am confused as to, do you have a thought, Ms. Baker, on why? It goes on to say it must be used exclusively for public purpose. Now maybe that's the component.
Ms. Baker, your evaluation of the Minnesota Constitution.
Mr. Chairman and Representative Lancaster, I think what you're getting at is that if in fact there are no legislative provisions to exempt all the 85 exemptions that, like the peaking plant that was just in here for, you know, that Representative Hackford just brought, that's a good example of the legislature deciding that they wanted to exempt something, and so they specifically have exempted it. If, in fact, the legislature has not specifically exempted it, then that provision is going to prevail. And that is probably why the Ramsey County Assessor looked at this property and said, this is not strictly for public purposes, and said, you know, something like this doesn't have a specific exemption like Representative Solberg is coming before the committee now to ask for, and therefore, you know, put it on the tax rolls. And it probably, you know, one could argue that maybe it should have been on the tax rolls in the past and they didn't realize it. You know, I don't know what the details and ownership and everything like that, but that's probably what happened with Ramsey County when they started looking at all the various, you know, details of some of the property once the new assessor came.
Thank you.
And I don't know how, there are a few other facilities like this, and we're not sure. I was just talking to them about how they're taxed either, so.
Mr. Chair, so members, as I understand it, these are full-time facilities that train full-time apprenticeship programs. And it's not my intent, as I visit with Ms. Baker, to open this up to any 501c3 or nonprofit that may indeed, you know, have some kind of a small apprenticeship program and then avoid the taxes.
But it seems to me that if, as I stated at the beginning, we may have some additional language to narrow this down a little bit to make sure we're solving the problem that we're solving. Additionally, let me state that when I first started teaching school, we had all kinds of Smith U programs that provided extremely good vocational training at our high schools. They've been eliminated. We had the day I got my master's degree, and I was teaching school, my next door neighbor's grandson just barely graduated from high school and went into our apprenticeship program at the U.S. Steel, because they operated their own at the time, was making more money than I was at the apprenticeship school. Those have been eliminated. And so we do need to, I think, have a good trades apprenticeship type of facility. And if, as we bring this down into the narrowness of it, if it's full-time, if it's a non-profit, if it's doing what it's supposed to do, and not opening it up to just somebody with the have a 501c3 and I run a apprenticeship program for an hour, and therefore keep my whole building tax exempt, that's my goal here. And I think it's if we get that additional language that we'll work on, I would appreciate that as we go forward.
Is there anyone else who would like to testify on this bill, House File 1531?
I'd just like to add one final comment.
Please do.
Thank Representative Solberg for bringing this issue before the committee tonight. And these programs are state or federally approved by our Department of Labor and Industry. So, I mean, it's a pretty narrow focus, just so you know that's what those words mean. But we will work with the author and certainly committee staff to come up with the right words to make sure it's very, very narrow. But they are indeed full-time schools, full-time teachers, faculty, and others.
Thank you. Any closing comments, Representative?
Well, Mr. Members, I hope you consider that, and as it goes forward, if we need to have some clarifying language, I would bring that amendment to adopt it for you. I will also say there's a little bit of which we don't quite understand the need for the 206 or the 208 date, and we may go back to the 206 date depending upon what that happens to be in our understanding of this. So as we narrow it down.
Thank you. Well, the chair will first of all congratulate Grandpa again.
Yes.
And then I'll lay over. And then lay over House File 1531. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And we have one more bill left. Representative Mallory is just minutes away. So if we can just sit tight here for a few minutes and hear the final bill. Representative Walker.
As long as we have some time and we have released the citizens' idea bill after our balloting, perhaps you can tell us if you contacted the idea generators to let them know they're so honored.
Great question. And in fact, that was put in the hopper Tuesday and should be introduced, I think, tomorrow. But Mr. Cummings, how are we doing on potential testifiers for those six portions of the bill?
Mr. Chair and members, Representative Loeffler, we have worked to contact all of them. We have four of the people that we have notified. There are two that we're still trying to get a hold of. And we do have people that are going to be coming in to talk about their provisions when they come in to talk about it. And it was also kind of interesting that they had questions. You know, they said, well, how many people does this work with, and you know, what does this mean for this? And so it was very exciting for them to see that their little idea was turning into a bill. Thank you.
We were hoping to get at least one for each portion of the bill and up to two, so it could, you know, go from 6 to 10 potential testifiers that day.
Mr. Chair, do you want me to read the results of my survey? I've been multitasking.
I understand that. You know, actually, Madam Chair, you can do anything in this committee. You understand that.
I asked about taxes. I don't have the answer, Jeff.
Well, I guess a few reminders, too, as we wait here, is on Friday, it will be a late day. We're doing LGA bills in the morning during a regular time. And then we will recess until noon. And then we're trying to include every bill, so we're actually adding some bills as they come in. And so there will be a Department of Revenue, I see, is cringing over there. As I think it's up until probably 7 o'clock Friday, 7 a.m. Friday morning, we'll be allowing bills on the Friday. We expect the Revenue Department to have everything up to date by then. And then on Tuesday, next Tuesday, we meet at 10, as the chair has graciously given us that time, and that's when we'll hear the citizens' bill. And then we're kind of looking, the local government committee heard 4 or 5 more local option sales tax bills that we'll probably hear maybe that Tuesday. And that probably will be our last meeting date, and then before we hopefully can unveil the division report that Friday, March
23rd. Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Anderson.
As we patiently wait for Representative Mullery, is it appropriate that we, and I know in the past there's been a kind of a penalty fee of donuts and coffee, and considering our meeting at 8 o'clock on Friday morning, and we're going to have a long day if...
Representative Anderson, I think you have brought up a great point, and has made the chair feel a bit guilty here, so there probably will be something forthcoming, so thank you. Would you write that down?
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
They're finishing up a bill, and it's dragging on, as you might expect, a little longer than we do have some testifiers. I'm not sure if it's appropriate. As
you know what? That's a great idea. If he can't make it, I think we'll start hearing testifiers. I think that's a great idea.
I've questioned you long enough for this one.
Absolutely not. Representative Manchesky, face boy, there's a power there.
You sent a real thug.
Representative Anderson with the power came up with the dumb concept. It's been explained to Representative Mullery.
Well, Representative Mullery, you have the final bill tonight, House File 1030, and do appreciate you breaking away from your committee, which you're chairing. And can we have someone move that?
Mr. Chair, I move that the House File 1030 be referred to the Committee on Appropriations.
Second.
Representative Lenchesky moves House File 1030 for possible inclusion.
Oh, that's...
We've only been going 2 months.
That's right. Well, would you care? You actually have. Would you? Representative Mullery moves 1030. I apologize for that, Ben. Very good. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The witnesses, I think everybody knows, well, maybe not, that's right, there's some new people on the committee. 4D property is a special classification for low rental where the owners have entered agreements on written restrictions, usually with, for instance, federal government, state government, and there's a few other special ones which the experts can get into. And last time we had a provision that was really difficult. We had quite a few didn't qualify because we had a 75% requirement on the number of units, and we want to change that. And the two testifiers want to explain why we are doing that. It's actually it turns out that, I was going to say rural Minnesota, but it's greater Minnesota, according to the chair. So most of the units are in greater Minnesota that are affected by this.
Okay. Yes, thank you. If you would please state your name and proceed with your testimony.
Hi, my name is Caroline Horton. I work with Central Community Housing Trust. We're a provider of affordable housing in the Twin Cities metro area. Right now we own and operate about 1,450 apartment homes. First of all, thank you for support of this legislation 2 years ago. It has had a very positive impact on our properties. We have about 700 properties that were eligible last year for the lower classification rate, reducing taxes on those units by just over about $200,000. So fairly significant savings. Those taxes returned to the levels that we saw in about 2003. So about 3 or 4 years prior to the new rate, our taxes have reverted to about those same levels. We were able on our properties to use those tax savings to do a number of things. In a couple of cases, we had properties that had operating deficits. We were able to bring them back to break-even operations or slight positive cash flow. Other properties had not been able to make deposits to replacement reserves in those 2 years prior, and we were able to start making those deposits again to deal with future capital improvements. On some of the properties, we were able to use some of these savings and taxes to make capital improvements. In a couple of cases, we had downtown properties where the surrounding neighborhoods had some real crime and safety issues, so we were able to install some security systems and do some other things in the property to really protect the properties and those residents from encroaching crime and safety issues, which was very important. We found that there are two groups of properties that are not eligible for this lower classification rate. One group is those that are funded only through local government funding, not through federal funding or state funding. We have a couple of those properties, three properties in 06 that were not eligible. The second group is based on the threshold. Right now, 75% of the units in a property must meet the affordability restrictions in order for that property to qualify and get the prorated tax classification. 75% was when it was set, you know, somewhat arbitrary, and unfortunately at that time, I think it was not understood that a lot of the properties in greater Minnesota are mixed income properties and they do not meet that threshold. And that's where the request for reducing that to 20% is primarily coming from. With that, I will turn this microphone over to Michael.
Thanks. Mr. Chairman, good evening. My name is Maureen Warren, and I'm the Director of Supportive Housing and Employment Services for the Amherst Wilder Foundation here in St. Paul. We're an operating foundation, which means we don't make grants to other agencies. It means we actually provide the services, and we're in the social service areas. We do school success programs, troubled children, community mental health, and affordable housing, as well as we have a substantial research division that does research on interest to the broad community, most recently this morning, homelessness. I wanted to give you one example. While my colleague is right that this will have the largest impact on greater Minnesota, within Wilder owns and manages 11 properties consisting of 1,600 units, and all of our properties are supportive housing, which means not only are the units affordable, but we have folks on site that are providing supportive services to the individuals that live in the units, making connections to mental health resources in some cases, to living resources, home health care in our seniors building, providing education resources, on-site computer labs, a whole variety of really life skills services for the folks that live in our properties. We think this is really important not only for the residents, but it ensures better property management as well. I wanted to give you one example and tell you that even within our own portfolio, we own some of our properties and we manage them, and we also manage for others. We manage a building called Redeemer's Arms that some of you may know. It's right on Highway 94 in Dale, and it is serving 151 individuals. It's efficiencies with a few one-bedrooms thrown in, and it was developed by the oldest Lutheran congregation in Minnesota, which is Lutheran Church of the Redeemer, and in 1991, the property was in pretty sad shape, and the church felt with only 200 remaining parishioners, they were unable to really manage the property. They asked the Wilder Foundation to begin managing it, and we have. Most of the folks that live there now, their primary income source is SSI. They're largely disabled under a mental illness or chemical dependency issue. This building happens to have 150 units, 82 of which are subsidized by HUD, and there's not a lot of science to that. The best way I can explain it is that HUD does what we all do when there's scarce resources. When you put in for a project for a full funding, they allocate resources, and this one just happens to have 82 out of 150, so it misses the threshold. The impact of this on my books is the manager, and I do get paid a management fee for managing the property on a per-unit basis, but the taxes went up from 2004 to 2005 from $84,000 to $127,000, or a 46% increase. It was followed the next year by an increase of 7.8%. There's no way that property generates enough money to pay any of these taxes. There was not substantial reserves. Now I happen to work for the Wilder Foundation. The way we dealt with it is we paid the taxes, and we have an item on our books called Payable to Wilder. I pretend that someday the property will generate enough revenue to pay me back that debt that they owe me, but I don't think that's ever going to happen. I've scrubbed the books. I've appeared before the pastor when he says, "Now let me get this straight. You paid a bill for me because you didn't want a bad name, and now you want me to pay you back, and I don't have any money, and you should know better than anybody else that I can't get this money out of the property." So I just tell you that as an illustration. I think what will really happen in my case is I'll dance with my auditor until he tells me I have to write it off, and I will write it off, is what I think will be the predicted outcome. But generally, in Wonder Wilder, the foundation makes a $100,000 contribution to ending homelessness, we have a press conference or we celebrate in some way. So I just thought that this story kind of illustrated kind of the threshold not making a lot of sense for folks that are doing it. And again, I know that the story could be repeated and even more often out in upstate Minnesota.
Thank you very much, Ms. Warren. Ms. Warren and Representative Mallory.
Mr. Chairman, I just wanted to say I've been told that the Revenue Department does support these changes that are requested here.
And I see a nod of the head, let the record reflect, from Mr. Hagen from the Department of Revenue. Affirmation of your remarks there, okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Do you have any other testifiers?
I don't believe there's any more
questions. Any questions for the testifiers? Otherwise, is there anyone here in the audience? Representative Paymar.
Thank you, sir. I was just confused by the last testimony. I thought that the threshold was 75.
And percent of 151. And I'm at 82 units. So I don't make 75%.
Oh, I see. Okay, well then my question maybe is
to either of the testifiers or Representative Mullery is, I can see that this this would benefit Greater Minnesota, but would there be any disincentive to provide low-income housing by reducing the threshold to 20% of the units?
Very good question. Representative Mullery. Ms. Corton.
Sure, I'd be happy to address that. The eligibility requirements in the current statute require there to be state or public, state or federal funding. And of course, we're requesting that that be changed to include local. And generally, those regulatory agreements that establish that funding between the state or the entity and the owner establishes the number of units that must be rented at the or within the designated rent limits during the compliance term of that loan or of that funding agreement. So generally the owner isn't going to have the flexibility to decide, well, you know, now we're only going to provide 50% of our units or 20% of our units with affordable rent versus the 75% or higher. So it's generally not an opt-in type of thing.
Representative Pima.
That's okay. I'm not sure I understand it, but that's okay. I'll talk to them later. I'm not sure I totally get that.
Okay. Representative Brown?
I don't pretend to know the ins and outs of this either, but I know that in my district, home in Albert Lee, that we do have two low-income facilities that are very, very similar. And from my understanding, one of them is classified as 4D, and one is not, but they are so very similar that, you know, to anybody in Albert Lee, I could not tell why one qualified and one did not, and they have similar populations, similar incomes, the building structure is very similar, and I know that this would bring both of them a benefit.
Any other comments? Anyone from the audience? Again, here to testify for or against. All right. Any closing comments, Representative Mullery?
Basically, Mr. Chairman, just I think this is a good program. We really treated, as you know, 4D property really bad in the 2001 bill. It was the only kind of property in the state that was increased in their class rate. And we've been trying to help them since then, since that was realized. And I think this makes sense to bring in units that, you know, what's the difference if it's a local government or a state grant? They're both for the same purpose. And so that part just seems totally logical. And the other part, we're just trying to bring in other ones that really thought that they were covered, and then we kind of took them out. And so suddenly they're stuck with a bad cash position.
Thank you very much. The chair will lay over House File 1030 for possible inclusion. And members, thank you for your attendance tonight. We are adjourned.